time for a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Joel Magnuson. Joel Magnuson is an internationally recognized economist specializing in non-orthodox approaches to political economy. He is currently a professor of economics in Portland, Oregon, a visiting fellow at the Ashcroft International Business School at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England, and is an international advisor to the editorial board of Anglia's journal Interconnections. He is an active member of an international research group based in Europe that is working toward new philosophical foundations for economic theory and practice, and he writes extensively on historical events and issues related to capitalist development. And he is here to talk about his book, Mindful Economics, How the U.S. Economy Works, Why It Matters, and How It Could Be Different. Joel, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Mindful Economics?
Well, I decided to put this book together a few years ago as a kind of primer or resource for people who are interested in building alternative economic institutions and really directly engaging in real democracy. And, you know, it's... Economics is a kind of area that a lot of people have sort of a superficial understanding of things, but what we really need is a much deeper understanding of its history and its most powerful institutions and so on. So I put this book together for people that really want to learn more about the economy because they're interested in social change.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how much, for instance, with our local television news coverage is focused around economics. And, for instance, the stock market report is something we get every night, yet how few of us really understand what the heck goes on at the stock market.
That's right. That's right. And it's really important, I think. It's an important, certainly right now, people are paying a lot of attention to the economy, the reports on the economy, but yet having difficulty sorting it out, you know, and it's like there are certainly things that I recognize are important and don't know anything about, but I probably should, you know, like I know that I need to have a pancreas, but I don't know what it does exactly, you know. I know I can't live without one, you know, but it's that sort of thing. It's sort of people need to do some hard work and really dig into some of this material and find out what's going on out there. So I think this book can be a good guide for people to do that.
So what is your sense with our current economic crisis? We are hearing from a lot of economists and analysts, you know, telling us what's really going on. What's your sense for what is not being talked about in the current situation?
Well, there's a number of things. One of the things that I find most ironic, actually, right now is the fact that there's so much economic bad news coming out over the last year with the record foreclosures, record bankruptcies, and particularly in the financial sector. It looks like General Motors now is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. Certainly they're losing money at historic rates. So is Ford, Chrysler, you know, all the big auto manufacturers in the United States are doing very poorly. I saw a report come out just the other day about job loss, and we've lost about 1.2 million jobs over the last 10 months, and about half of that has occurred just in the last 2 months. So there's all this bad news coming out right now at a time when we're actually not officially in a recession yet. And so people say, well, what do you think about the recession? But we're actually not in one yet. Officially, we have to be, over a 6-month period, have our real GDP actually contracting for 2 consecutive quarters or that 6-month period. And that hasn't happened yet. So, all this bad economic news is coming out at a time when the economy is actually still growing. So, nonetheless, the recession is imminent, it's coming down the pipes, and it's very difficult to say exactly how deep it's going to be or how long it's going to be, but it is coming. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens at that point. You know, and I think this job loss report is a pretty good indicator of that. Also, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what this banking bailout entails. And I think part of the reason why there's misunderstanding is because Paulson and others were somewhat disingenuous about what their intentions were when they sold this bailout plan to Congress. Originally, the idea was, well, you know, we have all these banks now that are sitting on these toxic mortgage-backed assets, you know, these securities that have no real value. They've had to write down their assets and their balance sheets. And, you know, as a result of that, all these banks and finance companies turned on one another and stopped lending credit. And so everything just kind of ground to a halt. And so the idea was to come up with this fund where they could go in and buy these assets, get the money back into the banking system, get the machinery of finance start rolling again. And, you know, the Treasury Department will sit on those assets for a while, wait for those values to improve. They sell them. And they actually said that the government could, in the long run, make a profit on this. But what they're actually doing instead is buying newly issued preferred stocks from banks and allowing these banks to buy other banks. And there's no provisions in there about unlocking the credit markets and you know, working the plan that was originally sold to Congress. So the principal beneficiaries of that plan have been J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all these giant banks that are receiving tens of billions of dollars now in equity trades. The Treasury Department is actually buying stocks in these banks, and these are the banks that are going around buying other banks. So it's what we've created is a kind of investment banking wing within the Treasury Department that's providing money, you know, liquidity for these banks to consolidate and carry out mega mergers in the banking industry. And I think if they would have told Congress this was their intention, then the bailout plan would never have passed.
What in the past has been done with situations like that when there's a crisis and they need to take over or, you know, rein in an industry like that?
Rein in the industry? Well, you know, this has all traditionally been the job of the Federal Reserve System, not the Treasury Department, you know, to provide emergency loans to the banks that are experiencing liquidity shortages or, you know, lowering interest rates or raising interest rates depending on what's going on in the economy, and not the Treasury Department. You know, the Treasury Department really has no direct role in the banking industry other than they're sort of the bookkeepers and the accountants for the federal government. And, you know, they're sort of like a Kinko's printing press, you know, for the Fed. But, it, you know, not since 1971 when we ended the Bretton Woods system and the gold exchange standard has the Treasury Department been involved directly in banking or controlling the money supply for that matter.
Well, you mentioned the Fed, and obviously Bernanke is one of the people that's been trotted out here with the solutions of late. So what have you seen as their current role in this current situation? And talk a bit more about the Fed, if you would, because, again, there's another institution that you would think with all that we hear about the Fed, and it's been, you know, regularly trotted out on TV for my entire lifetime, that I would have a much greater understanding of what the Fed does, and yet it's a big mystery to me.
Mystery, yeah. Well, the Fed, the first part of your question, what has the Fed been doing? They've aggressively lowered interest rates over the last year and a half, 2 years, trying to free up as much credit as possible to try to stave off the problems that we're seeing unfolding right now, which didn't really work. So they tried that. But also they've made a fair amount of money available to, again, these private sector banks like J.P. Morgan to go and buy other companies. And I don't know if you remember back, I think it was in the spring when Bear Stearns was the first one of these big investment banks to really get in trouble. And J.P. Morgan Chase then got an emergency loan from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York to buy Bear Stearns. So the Fed actually has been playing a very similar role as the Treasury Department is now in providing money for these banks to buy other banks, which traditionally is also not the Fed's job. The Fed, their primary responsibilities are to stabilize the money supply and prices, but also to try to sustain high levels of employment as well. Those are its main jobs. And it was created by an act of Congress, chartered to do those very specific things. Certainly it's not to play a role in facilitating the consolidation of the banking industry. I think one misunderstanding, possibly popular misunderstanding about the Fed is that people think it's part of the federal government, and it's not. It's quite separate and distinct. It operates on its own earnings. Its earning comes from interest on bonds that it owns. And, you know, aside from the fact that the chair and the members of the Board of Governors are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate in the same way that a Supreme Court justice would, aside from that, their connections to the federal government are pretty minimal. They're quite independent. And I think that the idea was that we don't want the executive branch of the government, which has war-making powers, also be married to the central bank, which has control over the money supply. You know, we have a long history in this country and other countries as well of governments that want to engage in war, but they don't have the money to do it, so they just go out and they print up a bunch of money to finance it. So they, when they created the Fed, they put this firewall between the executive branch of the government and those that control the purse strings.
And the Fed has individual smaller banks that are in different regions across the country?
Well, it's structured around a 12-district bank system. So there's 12 Federal Reserve banks, and each is independently incorporated. Each has its own board of directors.
So the one for our region, what would that do different than the main one?
Well, there is no main one exactly. Okay. I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York has greater responsibilities because it's that bank that carries out the bond trades that the Fed uses to control the money supply. Otherwise, they're separate entities, and they have representation on the Board of Governors, which is the sort of the executive body of the Federal Reserve System overall. Part of the mystique of Alan Greenspan's tenure was that he was very effective in getting all of the 12 district banks to form a consensus, which was, you know, historically a difficult thing to do, and also currently Bernanke is having a difficult time doing that as well, getting all of the 12 banks on the same page. But Greenspan was very effective in doing that. Dallas particularly seems to be a maverick, so to speak, in that sense.
Well, speaking of mavericks, or pseudo mavericks, when John McCain was running on his campaign for president, he had criticized Barack Obama for wanting to spread the wealth, and he likened it to something. He basically said it was socialism, what Barack Obama was trying to bring in. What's your take on that?
Well, I certainly don't, from what I've seen of Barack Obama's plans, I don't see anything that strikes me particularly socialist. I mean, some of it's progressive, as you would expect from a Democratic administration. There's been some talk about raising the top marginal tax rate or the top tax bracket for the highest income earners, a modest increase, I think, to restore it back to where it was during the Clinton years. Other things like fairly modest subsidies for education, for research and development, particularly in green energy initiatives, subsidies for businesses that repatriate jobs, bring jobs back to the United States, that sort of thing. So, you know, pretty standard progressive reforms, but nothing that I would consider socialism. I think that was just kind of some hardline right-wing rhetoric, you know, directed at the Obama campaign. Although, you know, in the context of those conversations, people talked about things like, well, we're all socialists now because we're nationalizing, or at least partially nationalizing, the banking industry. But I certainly don't see it that way. I don't see that as a movement towards socialism. And in fact, what I'm seeing, in my view, is this is more of the other way around. This is private sector banks that are colonizing the Treasury Department. And part of the reason they could do that is because they have their man, Paulson, on the inside. He's sort of like the viceroy, the colonizers. It was just 2 years ago that Henry Paulson was, you know, at Goldman Sachs, a very large, very powerful investment banking company. They're heavily invested in the oil industry now, highly merged. And so, you know, they put him on the inside, and he created then, as a result of this banking crisis, he created an investment banking wing within the Treasury Department to trade securities. And the implications of that are profound, because the executive branch of the government, like the Treasury, which includes the IRS and those kinds of institutions, the executive branch of the government is supposed to be about enforcing laws. And it'd be very, very difficult now for the Treasury Department to be the biggest player in mortgage-backed securities and banking stocks trading business, and also be the watchdog or the referee of that business. There's a tremendous conflict of interest. Alan Greenspan, some years back when the Bush administration was flirting with the idea of privatizing Social Security, or partially privatizing Social Security, Alan Greenspan came out, at least initially, against it, because he said this would be a conflict of interest between the government and the securities industry. And now we've actually seen this come to pass.
So is Hank Paulson, with his creation of this wing within the Treasury, is that officially getting the Treasury into the whole casino economy?
Officially, that's right. Once that legislation was signed into law by Bush, then that placed the Treasury Department right at the center of the securities industry. They're the biggest player now, and they're buying bank stocks.
So do you anticipate, it's hard to know at this point, but have you seen any indication so far with the Obama administration coming in that any of that is going to change?
From what I've seen so far, no. Obama was right alongside Bernanke and Paulson and Nancy Pelosi and John McCain and others that were encouraging Congress to sign this legislation into law. I mean, it was like this emergency measure. Also, I see him surrounding himself with people also from the industry, you know, Warren Buffett, Diamond, who's right now the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Robert Rubin, who was Secretary of Treasury during the Clinton years, also from Citigroup. So, you know, there's that same group of people, Jason Furman, Andrea Tyson, all these people from the Clinton years that actually pushed for the deregulation of the banking industry, deregulation of energy derivatives, other derivatives, all the kind of kinds of deregulation that actually made this crisis come to pass. And these are part of his inner circle right now. So I find that disturbing. On the other hand, there are some other people in his inner circle that aren't from that group. So he's got a mixed bag there. But it seems to me that the people that really have his attention right now are banking industry, Wall Street insiders.
So if by some reason of magic you were suddenly brought into that administration and they put you in charge of fixing our economic system more in line with what you propose in your book, Mindful Economics, what would you be pushing for?
Well, I would be pushing for the decentralization of our banking industry and finance in general. And I think part of the reason why these crises can happen to the magnitude that they're happening now is because this industry is so highly centralized. I don't know if you recall back some years back when there was a major electricity blackout in the Northeast states, New York and some other states. It was just for like 2 days that entire region was without electricity. And it turned out that the reason for that was there was just one central mechanism that failed, and it just wiped out this entire multi-state area in terms of electricity. And so to me, that's a kind of metaphor for the problems that can arise from centralization. When you put all of your financial resources into the hands of four or five large Wall Street companies, and those companies make bad decisions, then the reverberations of that go all around the world. What I would propose as I think this is actually happening, and it has happened over many years, is for people to look more carefully at the smaller community-based banks and financial institutions in their own areas, in their own communities, or in their own towns. Credit unions, community banks, savings banks that operate in their own communities there. And if people were to focus on that and say, you know, I'm going to take my money out of this fund, this hedge fund, this mutual fund, and I'm going to put it into a community bank, then they're actually doing a number of things that I think are good. One is that they're committing resources to the vibrancy of their local community, which is sorely needed in places all around the country right now. But also they're contributing to stability, because as we decentralize our financial system and our banking system, then if one or two or more bank presidents or fund managers make a bad decision, it's not going to destroy the entire economy. And so we can absorb more crises that way with a more decentralized system. You know, a lot of this stuff is not new. The crises that we're experiencing are things that we've experienced in the past. What I write about pretty extensively in the book is the history of our most powerful economic institutions, like the Federal Reserve, our banking industry, the history of the corporation as an institution. And, you know, back in the 19th century, J.P. Morgan had essentially a monopoly in the banking industry, with branches stretched across the country, and it became very clear to farmers and other people at that time that J.P. Morgan Company really didn't have people in communities directly in his interest. What he was interested and is building massive trusts, big corporate monopolies, big investment projects in New York and San Francisco. So once people began to realize that these dominant institutions don't really have their interests at heart, they started putting together their own. And they started putting together financial cooperatives and savings banks, small-scale institutions stretched across the country. And they work, and they've been very stable, and they're still around today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know a lot of our regular listeners are familiar with the idea of, you know, supporting mom and pop businesses in their neighborhoods and, let's say, you know, not choosing to go to Walmart for the very reason that Walmart is, you know, basically sucking money out of each community and going towards their owners. And yet, how many of us don't choose to do that when it comes to banking? Because, you know, we're just used to these behemoth banks and somehow that seems safer.
Well, clearly that's not now, is it? You know, the pension funds now, I think the last report that I saw lost $1.5 trillion in the last year or so. And, you know, and this is following another massive hemorrhage of pension funds that occurred with the dot-com crash just a few years back. So people now are beginning to realize that there's no money left in their pension funds, and they're going to have to work until they're 80 years old. You know, so unfortunately, the harshness of what's happening right now is sort of a wake-up call for people in that respect.
I was just last night watching Enron, the smartest guys in the room, and was shocked at how much I'd forgotten about that. But essentially, when they're mentioning the same banks that are cashing in on the what is getting $25 billion or whatever a pop, were the ones that like had, you know, major investments with Enron, had okayed things. I mean, it's all the same players, basically.
Same companies, same institutions, same people. The people move around a bit, but they're the same central players. That's right.
So you are in town. You are speaking today at Elliott Bay Books.
That's right. 2:00 this afternoon.
Yeah. So, because we didn't really get a chance to go into very much nitty gritty about your book. I was kind of just giving you questions about our current economic situation. So what will you be covering today?
Well, I will be talking about the current situation, the current economic situation, and the banking crisis and the bailout plan, because inevitably people are going to be asking about that anyway. I am going to talk about the book. The book itself, just briefly, is organized in three parts. The first part is a survey of our institutions and their history and all the things that people hear about but don't really quite understand, like you just talked about, the Federal Reserve, Wall Street, the corporation, labor unions, government, that sort of thing. And then the second part is a few chapters on problem areas like environmental destruction, resource depletion is one, inequality is another. But there I talk about not only income and wealth inequality, but also political inequality and inequality of access to media. And then the third problem chapter is on financial market instability. Ironically, it's chapter 11. I didn't intend it to be that. It just sort of, that's where it fell in the book. And then the last part is what we can do about it. And there's a few chapters on how people can go about building locally based democratic economic alternatives, new institutions. So I'll talk a little bit about that this afternoon at Elliott Bay.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
We have just been talking with Joel Magnuson. He is author of the book Mindful Economics, How the U.S. Economy Works, Why It Matters, and How It Could Be Different. And again, he is talking today, Sunday, at 2 p.m. at Elliott Bay Books.